Bonjour et bienvenue à Paleo Cinema Podcast 118, otherwise known as Hello and Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 118. My name is Terry Frost, and yes, I'm doing French stuff this time around. I'm hitting the Nouvelle Vague pretty heavily, which means the French New Wave cinema, and both of the films are by Jean-Luc Godard, the first one being A Bout de Souffle, Breathless, and the second one being Band of Outsiders, which introduces us to the muse of Jean-Luc Godard, Anna Karenina. And I'm going to have a little bit of a fun with this one. It's going to be French music all over this podcast. As I have mentioned before, I'm doing a French language course online, and I'm doing okay with it. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But at the moment, things are going quite well, and I'm enjoying the challenge of trying to learn a second language in my mid-50s. Apparently, you're supposed to do it when you're 3 or 4 years old, but I'm not doing it that way. I'm going with the harder path and enjoying it a lot, and I'm actually getting a lot more out of the French movies, just knowing a little bit of the language. So it's a beautiful learning experience for me. And I'm going to enjoy sharing a little bit of it with you guys. So I will be back fairly soon with what I've been watching, and then we'll get into the first of the two movies. We'll go chronologically and look at Breathless first, starring Jean-Paul Belmondo and Jean Seberg. Catch you soon. Paleo Cinema Podcast is a 4-weekly podcast of movie appreciation. I do any movie more than 20 years old, and I will go all the way back to silent films if I absolutely have to. Feedback's one of the important things with a podcast, so you can supply feedback via the email address cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U @gmail.com is the primary way of doing this. There is also a voicemail line, which you can leave voicemails on, and it's area code 206-338-9397. Now, that's changed recently, so use that. You can go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook as well and join a few little discussions about movies that way. Now, this podcast does contain some adult material at times, so if you're not into that, fast forward through those bits and just enjoy the rest of the podcast anyway. I hope everyone's doing well. The weather is slowly warming up. The days are slowly getting longer here in the Southern Hemisphere, and we're running up to a federal election, so I'm tweeting lots of political stuff, and in general, a bit dismayed by the circus of it all. It's getting very American style in our political life here in Australia, where it's getting a bit more presidential than it should, given that we don't have a president. But it's still an interesting sociological thing, and lots of policies are being discussed, and there's lots of thought bubbles going out there. And in general, one of my other passions being politics, it's an interesting time to be in. But having said that, I have also watched a number of movies, which some of which are kind of cool, some of which less so, and I won't talk about those ones. On Bastille Day on the 14th of July, I decided to do a French movie festival at home. I was at home that day and decided that I'd hit a few French films, as you do. I did see Léon, otherwise known as The Professional, with Jean Reno and Natalie Portman in it. I enjoyed that one. I saw a very good zombie movie, a French zombie movie called The Horde from a number of years ago, which I really recommend. As I said in the Martian Drive-In podcast, it's a little like The Raid Redemption mixed with a zombie film. And superb stuff, really, really good stuff. And I enjoyed it. There's a few set pieces which are wonderfully over the top. And even if you don't speak French, you'll at least learn French swear words by watching that film, which is not an entire waste of time. I did also see another Godard movie as part of the French Film Festival. I saw Vivre Sa Vie, My Life to Live, which is a movie he did in the mid-60s with Anna Karenina. And it's basically an episodic kind of film. It's 12 little chapters in the life of a woman who becomes a prostitute. And she starts out as a kind of unsuccessful actress. She's left home and left her husband and child behind and is in Paris, has a number of lovers, and totally goes into prostitution. It's one of those old-type stories, but it's done in 12 scenes, in a sense. And really interesting for that. I'd recommend that one, too. And the last film I saw was one of the films I'm going to talk about today, which is Band of Outsiders. I did see that for the first time on the 14th of July and really enjoyed that. Now, outside of that French stuff, I did get a recommendation. I apologize because I don't remember who recommended it to me, of a documentary called Los Angeles Plays Itself. And I recommend that. It's a lot of little bits from films and also modern-day scenes filmed on the locations where a lot of films in Los Angeles were lensed. And really interesting. It's a little kind of staccato at times. It doesn't really hold together maybe as well as it should have. But having said that, it's one of those movies where you really do want to sit down with a pen and paper and just take down the names of the films that you see in the doco. It's on YouTube if you want to check it out, and I recommend that you do that. Really, really cool little doco. Not flawless. Obviously, the budget was fairly low for it. But I do recommend that you check that one out. Now, having said that, I'll go on to the other stuff I watched that was interesting. I did see Adaptation, finally, with Nicolas Cage and Meryl Streep and Chris Cooper and people like that in it. Not as in love with it as a lot of other people are. Yeah, it does kind of break down reality a little bit and kind of goes in slightly weird directions, but not really in love with that for some reason, and I don't know why. One day I might even bother to analyze it. But the other couple of things I've seen which are worth mentioning are, I saw Bullet to the Head with Sylvester Stallone, who shows the virtue of using human growth hormone to keep your career going. Not a bad little thriller based on a French comic book, of all things. But if you're in the mood for that kind of meathead action flick, you could do a little bit worse than that. It's not perfect, but it's not too bad either. And I rewatched an old Otto Preminger film, which was very controversial at the time for using words like panties and sperm. And that's Anatomy of a Murder with James Stewart, Lee Remick, and Ben Gazzara. Recommend that one highly. It really is an interesting film. I think, in a sense, the weakest link in it is James Stewart. I don't think he really brings his A-game to the movie. But having said that, the other actors in the film are superb. And if you haven't seen that for a while, or you haven't seen it at all, really do recommend that you do so. It's a kind of important American film of its time by one of the great rebels of Hollywood, Otto Preminger. So that's pretty much what I've been watching. Now, the two films we're going to talk about today, both by Jean-Luc Godard, they also happen to be in what is known as the Nouvelle Vague, the French New Wave, that flood of really interesting cinema that started in the late 1950s and going through all into the late 1960s, where basically there were a whole bunch of film critics who got together and did a magazine in the 50s called Cahiers de Cinéma, and had a philosophy. They were actually film critics who had a philosophy of cinema. They believed in the director as an auteur, as an author. They really believed that the best films of all genres are made in a documentary style, and they really did do a great gift to cinema in creating the concept known as film noir. They revisited a whole bunch of American films from the 50s and 40s and 30s, which hadn't been available during the war to the French, because basically the Germans and the Americans weren't really talking to each other in the 1940s. But they kind of revisited those, and they saw some interesting things that were happening in post-war American cinema and created that concept of film noir and adapted it in their own way to their own films. Godard was a part of the Cahiers de Cinéma mob, along with Truffaut and Chabrol, Jean-Pierre Melville, basically a who's who of French filmmakers at the time were a part of this. And on low budgets and with a documentary style and a very kind of guerrilla style of filmmaking, made some interesting films. Now, these two films, Breathless and Band of Outsiders, also have other virtues, and amongst those are the fact that they're among the coolest and most romantic films of the time. They really do give a great sense of young people in love and what it was like being young in Paris at the time during a great political turmoil and cultural change as well. After the war, France was pretty impoverished, obviously. And so general French culture tried to get nostalgic and tried to recreate France as it was before the war. And young people in the 50s particularly weren't really buying that. What they wanted to do was create a new France and take their own experiences and make them part of the popular culture, which is what these guys did. And there was a kind of tension at the time between the old school fuddy-duddy, well, not really fuddy-duddy in the sense that, say, America or England or Australia were at the time, but old school France and the new France of young people who were very influenced by American cinema and American culture, who were into jazz music and cars and Humphrey Bogart and all those other things like that. So there was that tension, and these two films really show the French embracing the tropes of American culture and American cinema, but adapting them in their own way. And these are just joyous films in a sense. There's a little bit of tragedy in them both, but there's also a lot of joie de vivre, you know, love of life. And both of these films get on anyone's list, anyone who knows films' list, of the top 100 films of all time. Not because they're big budget, marvelous color. They're both in black and white, these ones, but because they're intense and intimate films. And having said that, they're still a lot of fun, and they are extremely ultra cool. So I'm going to take another break now, and when I get back, I'm going to be talking about the first of the two 1960s Abou de Souffle, otherwise known as Breathless, not to be confused with the 1982 much lesser version starring Richard Gere.
The pretty girl, the bad boy, le revolver, the nice guy, the naughty girl, the wise guy.
Screenplay by François Truffaut.
Film noir, La Petite Américaine, The Thief, The Hanky Panky, La Police.
Technical advisor, Claude Chabrol.
The Bikini, Jean-Pierre Melville. The Shades, Humphrey Bogart. Renoir, Le Derrière. Action, Adventure, The Chase.
A film by Jean-Luc Godard.
Le Chapeau, The Égotiste, Le Smoking, Les Champs-Élysées, New York Herald Tribune, Tenderness.
Starring Jean Sibert and Jean-Paul Belmondo.
Betrayal. Violence. Murder. They Live by Night. Riffifi. Scarface. Gone Crazy. The film that shook the world. Breathless.
Okay, 1960s Breathless, otherwise known as Abou de Souffle, which means literally at breath's end. It's a 1960 film directed by Jean-Luc Godard, starring Jean-Paul Belmondo and Gene Seberg. Now, the trailer that you just heard says that the film was written by François Truffaut. Not exactly right. A lot of it was improvised at the time of filming. But Truffaut did write an original treatment, and Claude Chabrol also had a little bit of work in it. But mostly it was Godard's work. Now, the plot of the film, I'm going to grab this off the Wikipedia. Michel Jean-Paul Belmondo is a young, petty criminal who models himself on the film persona of Humphrey Bogart. After stealing a car in Marseille, Michel shoots a policeman who has followed him onto a country road. Broke and on the run from the police, he turns to an ex-girlfriend of his, Patricia, played by Jean Seberg, who's a student and aspiring journalist who sells the New York Herald Tribune on the streets of Paris. The ambivalent Patricia unwittingly hides him in her apartment as he simultaneously tries to seduce her and call in a loan to find their escape to Italy. To fund their escape to Italy, sorry. At one point, Patricia says she is pregnant with Michelle's child. She learns that Michelle is on the run when she is questioned by police. Eventually, she betrays him. It's kind of sort of a little bit based on a true story. In Paris in 1952, there was a guy called Michel Portal, who had an American girlfriend who was a journalist. Her name was Beverly Lynette. In November 1952, Portal stole a car to visit his sick mother in Le Havre and ended up killing a motorcycle cop named Grimberg. Truffaut, and I'm reading again from Wikipedia, Truffaut worked out a treatment for the story with Claude Chabrol, but they ended up dropping the idea when they couldn't agree on the story structure. Godard had read the treatment and decided he was going to make the movie. The main reason that Truffaut and Chabrol's names are on the movie was basically to get funding for it, because they'd just become the wunderkind of French cinema, and their names meant that you could get financing for the film. So that was kind of cool. Now, there's a few technical things about this film that are very, very interesting before I get into the characters. They wanted to use low lighting and natural lighting as much as possible in making the film, which meant they couldn't use normal film stock. So what Godard did with his director of photography, Raoul Coutard, was he found some still film stock. There was a film called, he said, looking it up, Ilford HBS film. It wasn't available as motion picture stock, but it was available as still film stock. They took 18 meter lengths of the film stock, which is sold for 35 millimeter still cameras, and spliced them together to 120 meter rolls. Basically, they pushed the negative one stop from 400 ASA to 800 ASA. The size of the sprocket holes on the film were different than the sprocket holes for movie film. And so they used a film called a Camaflex camera, which was the only one that they could get the sprockets to line up on. The problem with doing this, of course, was, well, not of course, but the problem with doing this was that the camera was very noisy. So all of the audio had to be post-synced, all of the dialogue, all of the sound effects, because the bloody camera was too noisy. Nonetheless, it did give Godard the portability and the ability to use natural lighting, which he wouldn't have had with standard film stocks. And this film, basically, they didn't get permission to do any of the filming, including a motorcade of President Eisenhower meeting Charles de Gaulle. There's little bits of the motorcade with Jean Seberg and Jean-Paul Belmondo running behind the crowds, which they didn't get any permission to do at all. They just did it from an upstairs window. And all of this gives it a really interesting documentary feel, apart from the personal story of the two characters, Patricia and Michelle. Everything else looks like it was set on the streets of Paris, because indeed it was set on the streets of Paris. Now, getting back to the actors, Jean-Paul Belmondo is one of the movie gods of French cinema throughout the 60s and into the 1970s. Really interesting character. He was born west of Paris. He was a boxer and a football player. And he was an amateur boxer from 1949 onwards. And won three straight first-round knockout victories from 1949 to 1951, which, given the fact that his nose looks like a boxer's nose, is hardly surprising. He did a whole bunch of other films. He did Pierrot Le Fou in 65 with Godard, L'Homme de Rio, which I've talked about in Paleo Cinema before, for Philippe de Broca, one of the films that influenced Indiana Jones in a really big way. He did Alain René's masterpiece, Stravinsky, which I've got to rewatch again because I did see it a long time ago, and a film that I'm kind of a part of the way through watching at the moment, The Burglars, also known as La Casse, which he stars in with Omar Sharif and has some really, really, really cool car chases in it. I'm going to enjoy finishing that one after I record the podcast and get it uploaded. But yeah, and Belmondo and Seberg are great together. Now, Gene Seberg was a discovery of Otto Preminger, who used him in his Joan of Arc movie in the late 1950s. And also in a movie that I saw earlier this year at the Australian Centre for the Moving Image, a film called Bonjour Tristesse, which also stars David Niven and Deborah Carr, and is based on a novel by a French author called Françoise Sagan, who wrote it when she was a teenager. Jean Seberg was a beautiful woman and a fine actress as well. If you see her in things like Bonjour Tristesse and this, and a movie she did in Paris in the early 1960s with Stanley Baker, which I like, called In the French Style, where she plays a not entirely dissimilar character to the one she plays in this film. But Gene Seberg had a lot of trouble in the 1970s, particularly 60s and 70s, because as an expatriate actress living in France, she was hounded by the FBI because of her support for the Black Panther movement. And this harassment, basically, and it was an intense amount of harassment, led her on to a severe depression, and she committed suicide in her car on the streets of Paris, and wasn't found for a number of days in the middle of quite a hot French summer. So unfortunate then for an actress who, in this film particularly, is brilliant and stunning, and a straight guy can't watch this film and not fall in love a little bit with Jean Seberg's character, Patricia, even though she does, for what she sees as good reasons, betray Michelle at the end of the film. Still, everybody who watches this film is a little bit in love with Gene Seberg, or at least every guy who's straight and lesbians. This isn't to say that the film isn't rough around the edges. It is the first feature film of a director. It was done on a relatively small budget, and there are bits of it, particularly right at the start where Michelle is fleeing Marseille and has the chase with the police, and it really it is a little bit kind of disjointed and doesn't hold together as well as later parts of the film, which I don't think makes the film suffer that much. I mean, it could have been a deliberate choice made, because the escape from Marseille and the encounter with the police and things like that was chaotic from Michelle's point of view. So you can have the argument that that's kind of in tune with that, to have such a disjointed bit of narrative in that part of the film. But when he gets to Paris and sees other girlfriends, but then hooks up with Patricia again, you really start to see the magic happen. Gene Seberg wearing a Herald Tribune t-shirt, standing in the middle of a Parisian street selling newspapers, is one of the great iconic images of French cinema at the time. And she's a stunning looking woman that plays really well with the intense physicality of Belmondo. He's jumping around, he's ducking and dodging, he's wearing sunglasses and a fedora, a suit slightly too big for him. He's always looking around, ducking and dodging, and almost dancing around this woman that he's trying to use as a person to provide a hideout for him, and be with whom he's falling in love. So there is that kind of edginess about Belmondo, particularly as there are a number of scenes where he's running through traffic. And this isn't the way it would be in a Hollywood film, where the traffic's incredibly controlled. This is Belmondo running across a French street while some dudes with a camera are behind him. And he does, even though right at the start he says he's a bastard, he says he's an utter bastard right at the start of the film, you kind of overcome that when you start to see how he is around Patricia. Yeah, he's kind of petulant and tells her she's ugly and he doesn't love her when she says something he doesn't like. And there are a number of times where Patricia says that he's a garçon, he's a boy, he's not a man. And he doesn't necessarily disagree with that. He wants to sleep with her. He basically keeps grabbing at her. He seduces her with his charm in a lot of ways. And she obviously has seduced him with her charm as well. And they're incredibly charismatic together. It's just lightning in a bottle, these two together. There's a prolonged scene in the very small flat that Patricia has where all there is basically a bathroom and a bed, and a small balcony overlooking a street. It's all filmed on location. There are no studio shots in this film, where they Godard really does make use of that small room. The different camera angles he gets stop it from being dull at all. But the three thing that really makes the scene work is the beautiful chemistry between the two actors and the incredible charisma that they both have. Belmondo is incredibly charming and magnetic and charismatic, and Jean Seberg's character Patricia is smart. She's ambitious in her career, but she's learning French. French obviously isn't her first language, being an American, and she keeps asking him what various slang terms mean, for instance, which kind of gives you a little bit of a sense of her vulnerability, which is something Jean Seberg had as an actor. In Bonjour Tristesse, it showed, and also in this and in a couple of other films, the fact that she was beautiful, intelligent, but there was a slight vulnerability that kind of makes men want to be protective about her. And you actually do get to see her working as a journalist. There's a bit where the two part for a time and she has to go and interview a famous novelist philosopher at Orly Airport, along with a crowd of other people who have giant reel-to-reel tape recorders and microphones and cine cameras, interviewing this kind of important philosopher who is played in the film, interestingly enough, by Jean-Pierre Melville, who later went on to direct Le Samurai with Alain Delon. But in this film, he plays a character called Pavelesco, who is asked about the nature of men and women's relationships and whether real love can happen in the 20th century and things like that. And he's throwing off slightly facetious one-liner replies to that. And you can see Patricia trying to get a question in. She has to ask the same question twice, for instance. But suddenly, Pavelesco is engaged by her. Apart from anything else, she's a beautiful woman. And partly her question and partly the fact that she is a beautiful woman gets Pavelesco to engage with her as a journalist, which is kind of interesting. And you see that with any kind of... If you have a look about... There was a documentary about the Hollywood stars turning up at Cinecittà Studios in Rome in the 1950s and 1960s, and the kind of questions that were asked of them when they were being interviewed at airports. And this is really in that kind of mode, where they ask them broad philosophical questions to get interesting little one-liner answers, and Pavelesco plays that. And maybe it's a slight pastiche on that kind of interviewing of Hollywood actors who come over to Europe to make films and they're suddenly asked about important philosophical concepts like true love and the relationship between men and women and things totally unrelated to the fact that they're coming over to play, in the case of someone like Kirk Douglas, a slave. But it's kind of cool. There are a couple of other people interesting in the film as well. Godard shows up at playing an informer. Philippe de Broca is an extra in the film. But there are three stars in this film, essentially. There's Jean-Paul Belmondo, there's Jean Seberg, and there's the city of Paris. And I love the fact that so much of it happens on the streets and in small areas around Paris. The stuff you wouldn't see, say, in an American film of the time filmed in Paris. You just tend to see what the tourist American films of the time, things like Paris When It Sizzles, for instance, which was a studio-based film filmed partly on the streets of Paris. You only get to see the touristy stuff there, but with these French films, you do get to see Paris through the eyes of someone who lives there. And I think that's fantastic. It's one of my three favorite cities in the world. And I like the fact that you get to see it as it was. Then that documentary thing that the New Wave directors had does give make a record of how Paris was at the time. I mean, obviously it was filmed a lot in the 1950s and 1960s, but particularly in a film like this one, you get to see the little interstitial bits that you wouldn't necessarily see otherwise, that, you know, what a cinema box office looked like, for instance, and little offices, and what a policeman's office looks like, and modeling studios, and all sorts of other things like that, which are kind of nice, and small apartments. There are several small apartments in this film, and a larger one as well. But just the layout of apartments and how people lived, and it's just wonderfully textured in that way, and it gives, which is something that's essentially a kind of romantic crime drama, love story kind of thing. It grounds it in a reality that it might not otherwise have had by the fact that it's filmed on these locations. And it's just a joy of a film. You've got Belmondo chain-smoking and donkey-ridding cigarettes off each other to light a cigarette. You've got Gene Seberg, and very ambivalent about Michelle, because she has her own life and her own things, and he wants her to run away to Italy with him so he can escape the police. And you can see her point of view all the way through the film, and that ambivalence. She does make love with him, of course, and in a sense she says that she loves him, but she doesn't want to be in love with him, which is kind of an interesting dynamic there. And I don't know whether it was written that way or whether Gene Seberg brought this to the film, but there is a strong sense of her as her own character and as somebody who has her own life and her own ambitions and her own world, into which this boyfriend with whom she had a casual affair comes back and tries to move all of that she knows and all that she has. In fact, she's about to start studying at the Sorbonne and move all of that out of there. And one part of her is in love with this incredibly charismatic but ultimately selfish and childish man. And the other part of her has an ambition. She wants to be a journalist. She wants to be a writer. She's already doing stuff for the Herald Tribune, even though she does have to flirt with one of the guys to get it done. It's a touch of the Mad Men there. But you can see her point of view. Now, the film ends, and this isn't a spoiler because the film is 53 years old. Inevitably, the police catch up with Michelle, and there's a beautiful scene at the end on the streets of Paris, which kind of embraces the cheapness of the film and the documentary approach to it. The camera follows Michelle down the center of a street after the police have caught up with him and wounded him. And I kind of like the fact that they've probably filmed it on the roof of a car, and it's not done with great kind of Hollywood smoothness. There's a roughness about it, as if a documentary film crew is following the character. And I really like that, and it does end on a lovely little grace note where Patricia catches up with Michelle, and they have their closure at the end of the film. This film just is cool and stylish, and I mean, there can be the argument made that it's style over substance, but I don't think so. I think the substance is there as well. It's just that the style is so brilliantly done and so engaging in a number of different ways that really you can't. Yeah, you can have the argument that there's a style over substance, but I believe there's a lot of substance to it. And it is one of the great films, and it's just a joy to watch. The subtitles were particularly a problem for me, and I've got to say this now, because I'm smug about it. Learning the little bits of French that I've got made it easier to read the subtitles, because I was also hearing the words, which were slightly different than the than the subtitles, not only hearing them but understanding more of them than I ever have. And it's also particularly useful with a character like Patricia in the film, whose French is quite rudimentary in a sense. It isn't as kind of jargony as Michelle's is, and she keeps asking him what various little bits and pieces mean. So that kind of was a nice entryway for me, Patricia's, you know, learning of French. kind of made it really work for me in a fun way. And if you are interested in the foreign language cinema of any kind, my sincere advice is learn some of the language if you can, because it's taken me to a slightly new headspace when I was watching this film, but one that I really liked. The fact that I knew what some of the words were and I knew the slight differences between them. And there are a couple of bits where I wound back and closed my eyes and just listened to the dialogue and understood what it meant, which gave me a great sense of accomplishment. And as I said, I'm smug about this. But it also made the film work for me at a slightly, I'm not saying a higher level, but at a slightly off to one side level that really I'm finding a bit interesting. So I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, we're going to talk about the second Jean-Luc Godard movie of this podcast, being Band Apart, also known as Band of Outsiders, which stars Anna Karenina, Sammy Frey, and Pierre Brasseur. So I'll be back with that very soon.
Le chat de la voisine qui mange la bonne cuisine et fait ses gros ronrons sur un balai de redondondon. Le chat de la voisine qui se met plein les papines de poules et de foie gras et ne chasse pas les rats. Miaou, miaou, qu'il est touchant le chant du chat. Ronron, ronron, et vive le chat, et vive le chat. Je ne dessinerai pas l'homme et son agonie, l'enfant des premiers pas qui gèle dans son nid. Je ne parlerai pas du soldat qui a peur d'échanger une jambe contre une croix d'honneur. Du vieillard rejeté aux poubelles de la faim, je n'en parlerai pas, mieux vaut ce petit refrain. Le chat de la voisine qui mange la bonne cuisine et fait ses gros ronrons sur un balai de redondondon. Le chat de la voisine qui se met plein les papines de poules et de foie gras et ne chasse pas les rats. Miaou, miaou, qu'il est touchant le chant du chat. Ronron, ronron, et vive le chat, et vive le chat. Je ne serai pas l'empêcheur de déjeuner en rond, allonger la sueur qui brûle sur les fronts. Je ne parlerai pas de l'ouvrier qui pleure la perte de ses doigts morts au champ du labeur. De la jeune fille fanée avant d'avoir aimé, je n'en parlerai pas, il vaut mieux glorifier. Le chat de la voisine qui mange la bonne cuisine et fait ses gros bonbons sur un balai de redondondon. Le chat de la voisine qui se met plein les babines de poules et de foie gras et ne chasse pas les rats. Miaou, miaou, qu'il est touchant le chant du chat. Ronron, ronron, et vive le chat, 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 et vive le chat.
That was a bit of an indulgence for me. That was Le Chat de la Voisine by Yves Montand, the actor. Yves Montand was raised a communist, and that song is kind of a bit of a social satire. One part of it's about a cat that gets fed really posh food, but the alternate verses are about people who do ordinary jobs and aren't treated well afterwards. Workers who lose their fingers in factory accidents, soldiers who lose their legs, things like that. So that he's kind of contrasting, you know, overindulged pets with the real problems of real people in a kind of satirical way. It doesn't translate well into English, but I thought I would indulge myself because it's my podcast. Now on to Band of Outsiders. After making Breathless, Godard had a real interesting few years. I'll just go through the movies he made in between the two. He did a couple of short films, one called Charlotte and a Boyfriend, another called Story of Water. He made A Woman is a Woman, Une Femme est une Femme. He did a couple of episodes of portmanteau films, one called The Seven Deadly Sins, a segment called La Presse, and another in a thing called Rogo Pag, a segment called Il Nuovo Mondo. He made The Little Soldier with Anna Karenina in it, and Vivre Sa Vie with her in it as well. and two films in 1963. La Carabineros, which was a big failure. It was about his kind of reflections on war. And Le Mépris, otherwise known as Contempt, which was a big widescreen CinemaScope movie he made with Brigitte Bardot, Michel Piccoli, Jack Palance, and also Fritz Lang in it. You might have seen that. So he kind of had a big failure with Le Carabineros and then a big success with Le Mépris. And then kind of went back a little bit and decided to make a film much more in the mode of, by this stage he was married to Anna Karenina, and decided to make this film, which was a kind of another meditation on gangster films in a sense, with Sammy Frey in it and also Pierre Brasseur. Now, I'll just see if I can find a decent outline of the film. It's a little bit complex, but we'll see what comes up. Okay, I'll wing it. A girl called Odile, played by Anna Karenina, meets a man named Franz in an English language class. She's told him that the house that she lives in with her adopted aunt and uncle, there's a lot of money in it. Now, Franz and his mate Arthur, played by Claude Brasseur, decide, being criminals as they are, that they are going to get Odile to help them steal the money. So they kind of semi-smuggle Arthur into the English language class. And there's a nice little scene there, well, a couple of little scenes there, where Arthur basically seduces Odile in the middle of an English language class, with just little gestures, little notes that get passed to her, just little looks and things like that. Now, Odile's a kind of shy girl. She's not very worldly. She has her hair in a very unflattering style, and Arthur tells her that it is an unflattering style. And in the class, she just lets her hair down literally, almost as a symbolic gesture that things are going to change for her. Now, the thing is that she's kind of the hinge in a three-way relationship. Franz, played by Sammy Frey, who honestly is a better-looking guy than the other guy, Arthur, has the hots for Odile, and who wouldn't? But Arthur, being a somewhat shallower and maybe a little nastier and more cynical criminal, is seducing her as much for the help she can give them in robbing the house as for any real attraction to him. Now, Franz is a little bit more lost. He's a little bit of a ditherer. He isn't quite able to seal the deal with a deal, which is a bit of a wordplay. And then gets kind of pissed off with Arthur when he does. And a lot of the film is them two jockeying for position around her, sitting at tables and cafes, sitting in a car, just in general trying to get it closer to Odile than the other guy. And it's quite an amusing continuing dance almost. And I'm using dance deliberately because there is a dance in the film of the two guys jockeying for position. Now, one of the other complications is that Arthur comes from a criminal family and his uncle and aunt want in on the deal. So that gets a little bit complicated. But the main thing is the dance between these three people and the kind of relationship that forms. There's already a strong friendship between Franz and Arthur. They play cowboys and Indians with each other when they have a spare moment or two. They share a car. They're just kind of buddies. They read newspapers to each other. They talk to each other about books they've read. They're movie buffs, things like that. But in the world of the film, the crime itself is kind of secondary to the love story between the three of them. And there are a few set pieces in this film which have become incredibly famous and incredibly influential. Now, there's also the other dynamic, which is between the house on the river where the money is, which is kind of out in the outer suburbs. It's in the boondocks, in a sense. And the city where Franz and Arthur live. And it's been mentioned in one of the things I read that the money sitting out in this small manor house out by a river should be in the city where it can be used rather than sitting in a cupboard in a house because a fairly rich guy has cheated on his taxes and has stashed the money in the closet, in a sense. I'm not explaining that very well, so I do apologise. But the set pieces are what really makes it. There are a few of them. There's two scenes in a cafe, one of which is where they talk about a minute's silence and having a minute's silence and how long a minute can seem. And so Odile gets the three of them to be silent for 1 minute. All sound in the soundtrack dies. The cafe around them, everything just dies. While the three of them look at each other and fidget. And it's a way, in a weird way, of kind of reinforcing the relationship between the three. Franz's uncertainty, Arthur's cynicism, and Odile being in love with the two of them in a way. They stop the minute silence after 37 seconds because Franz just goes, I've had enough of this, I'm out of here. And then there's another scene in the cafe, which is something that probably is the reason Quentin Tarantino named his production company Band Apart. And that is the dance sequence. They do a version of the Madison, the three of them spontaneously in the cafe. The music starts playing and the three of them dance together with Odile in the middle and the two guys on either end just doing a kind of soft shoe shuffle dance. And the other thing I haven't mentioned is there's a narrator. There's a narrator who kind of breaks the fourth wall in a sense and doesn't hide the fact that this is a movie. And what the narrator does is explains little bits of the plot line and throws in inconsequential asides. So while they're doing the dance, the music's playing. The music stops, but the sound of them dancing, clapping hands, feet stamping on the floor continues. And the narrator tells us what each of the three characters are thinking while they dance. Another way of kind of reinforcing where the characters are emotionally in the film. And it's kind of cool, and the dance sequence is great. The music's by Michel Legrand, one of the best film composers of all time in my book, and one of the best French film composers. In fact, they've actually got a nod to another Michel Legrand film, where Odile goes to the toilet in the cafe, and part of the soundtrack of The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, and all of the dialogue in Umbrellas of Cherbourg is sung, plays while she's down there in the cafe. So there's just this little bit where, which is a nod to another film Legrand did with Jacques Demy. So that's a kind of cool bit. I didn't notice it the first time I watched this film a few weeks ago, but I picked it up the second time. I really should have picked it up the first time, but maybe I wasn't paying attention. So they eventually get to the stage where they do rob the house and things go pear-shaped, but that's not really the important piece of the film. The important pieces are the bits beforehand, where the three of them are dancing around each other and getting to know each other, and the two men are jockeying for silence. Oh, yeah, I didn't mention the other set piece. There are three set pieces. There's the minute of silence. There's the Madison scene, which influenced Tarantino, particularly in Pulp Fiction. The dance sequence between Uma Thurman and John Travolta is heavily influenced by that. Apparently, according to Wikipedia, it influenced scenes in Hal Hartley's Simple Men and Martin Hine's film The Go-Getter. The other scene is the Louvre run. The characters attempt to break the world record for running through the Louvre, and the narration informs them that their time was 9 minutes and 43 seconds, which broke the previous record set by Jimmy Johnson of San Francisco by 2 seconds. The scene also is referenced in Bernardo Bertolucci's film The Dreamers in 2003, in which his characters also break the Louvre record. And it's a joyous thing to see these three people holding hands running through the Louvre, and I don't know whether the guards were in on it or not, but they do try to stop them. Now, Godard, being a bit more famous at this stage, probably had permission to be in there. You would have had to have permission. But there are it's got a spontaneity and an anarchy about it, which is really cool. Not a very long sequence at all, but it really is that kind of liberation of youth and doing silly things when you're young. There's a lot of that in there. And I really do like that. I like the fact that they go from the seriousness of planning the robbery, they go for the two guys talking to each other about the girl, and sometimes the way guys do, not pretending that they don't care about her. There's a little bit of that in there as well, where both of them in their own ways do. And it's just, there are lots of little bits in this film, but it does hold together really well. It's kind of a meditation on youth and love and Paris and crime novels and romance. There's quite a romantic scene with Arthur and Odile on the Paris metro, where she talks about what she wants, that she wants a marriage, and he asks her what marriage means to her, and she tells him in kind of very naive terms what she thinks marriage is about. And they talk about how sad people look when they're on trains and things like that. So there are these little meditative moments which are really touching and interesting as well. It's a lovely film. And I think that, unlike Breathless, I'm glad they didn't really remake this film, though the Bertolucci film a little bit comes close. It's just a lovely film. It's very complex and dense, but it's Godard being playful as well. He breaks the fourth wall all the time. Odile looks at the camera and says, "Pourquoi?" at one stage when they were saying, "What's our plan for the robbery?" And she goes, "Pourquoi? Why have a plan?" in a sense. And those things, and she does have a couple of asides to the camera as well, just glances at the camera, which are deliberate. They're not accidental kind of things, which tell us that it's a film and to just enjoy it as a film. They kind of totally get rid of that conceit that most films have, that it's not a film, that people in the film pretend it's not. In this film, they don't necessarily do that. And having the narrator talk over the top of them really reinforces that in a sense. Now, this was actually based on a novel which was translated into French. It's actually an American novel which was translated into French and got hold of course. And it's a novel called Fool's Gold by an American author called Dolores Hitchens. Don't know too much about her, but one of the other things, which is the kind of stuff that you like, this is the kind of stuff the French directors said about their work. Of course, it is another New Wave film. In fact, there's a scene where Odile walks underneath a neon sign in Paris that says Nouvelle Vague, New Wave. Godard described it as Alice in Wonderland meets Franz Kafka. See, that's the sort of shit that French film directors should say. Weird stuff that kind of, on one hand, you got Alice in Wonderland, mega pop culture. On the other hand, you got Franz Kafka, which is literary. And that's it for this one. It's a lovely film. I do like Le Grand soundtrack. It's not really obvious. It's not as large as a lot of the other things he did at the time, but it underlies the action quite nicely. Budget on this one, only $120,000, which is kind of cool. After doing Le Mépris, I suppose Godard wanted to get back to black and white and wanted to get back to small budgets and that hit-and-run filmmaking that he'd done previously with Breathless. But I'm going to have to dive into more of his cinema, having seen Vive Sa Vie and these other two films. I'm really going to have to hit a little more of his stuff. Of course, he did Alphaville as well, which I talked about in an earlier podcast. But the things, and I think I've seen Le Mépris once. That's the problem with doing this fucking podcast, the fact that looking at the films for the podcast, it's like I spread seeds everywhere and I've got to follow them and watch them grow, and I've got to watch all the other films that the research on these films digs up. It's a vicious cycle and I don't really have enough time to do it all, but I'm going to have a go at it and try to kind of filter in, sort of mix in some Godard with my future film watching. It's not hard to find films these days, is it really? But anyway, I'm going to take another break. I want to get back. It's going to be the feedback time. So definitely, if you haven't seen it, check this one out. Definitely check out Breathless as well. They're a lot of fun. You do have to look into them a little more deeply than you would with some other films, but it's ultimately kind of rewarding to do that. That was Hugo Montenegro, the guy who did the theme from I Dream of Jeannie with his version of the theme from the French movie Man and a Woman. Okay, we've got feedback. I've got feedback first from Morris from the Love That Album podcast. Morris says, "Hey Terry, I really dug your Taxi Driver episode and always love hearing great discussions about films I love. I first saw it 30 years ago when a friend dragged me to a screening at the Melbourne Uni Cinema. Like Clockwork Orange, it's one of those films that really leaves you feeling staggered after the first viewing. For what it's worth, I've always seen a similarity between Travis Bickle and Holden Caulfield from Catcher in the Rye. I've always felt that Bickle is a grown-up version of Caulfield. Both are very insular, have a very insular vision of society and its weaknesses. Both have a very strong desire to protect childhood innocence, Iris and Phoebe, while contradictingly they seem to have their own perversions. Of course, Bickle doesn't want to say much and struggles to find words when he does, and Caulfield won't shut up. I often wonder whether Paul Schrader was thinking of this favourite book of mine when putting Taxi Driver down on paper. That's my 2 cents worth. Hope you and Sal are well. Cheers, Morris." I've got to confess, Morris, I haven't read Catcher in the Rye. When other people were reading that, I was reading Ian Fleming novels and shit like that. But I'm willing to believe you on that. I do trust your instinct with these things. And thanks very much for the feedback, mate. Let me see what else we've got here.
"Hey, Terry, it's Tim from the Internet and Central New York. Take two on the phone call that I'm giving you. Anyway, what I was attempting to say in my last phone message, aside from, of course, love your show, love paleo cinema, love Martian Drive-In, and I think you should keep them both separate. The question you asked a few issues or episodes ago, I think you should keep them separate because for a lot of people, they come in to hear your work because they either want to hear about older movies or older genre movies, and then they hear one and they go, well, I'll try the other. And so I'm kind of thinking that, yeah, keeping Paleo Cinema and Martian Drive-In separate is actually a good idea because it means you end up getting more fans that way. But that's not really the reason I'm calling. The reason I'm calling is because of something you said back in, I think it was Paleo Cinema 50. I don't have the note I wrote down, where you were talking at some length and asking the audience to make some suggestions about what they thought the future of movies and video would be. And I remember listening to that and thinking that I think as more normal, as in non-fan, people consume movies and video from things like Netflix streaming, Hulu streaming. I don't know if you have either of those in Australia, but in the United States, we have Netflix has a large streaming service where most of the major movies and a number of films from that go in and out of circulation and some original series that Netflix has started doing are offered via streaming. And Hulu is an online streaming service for a number of the television networks, which put out their older shows that way, plus selected movies from various countries and stuff. So I'm thinking that that's what most normal people are using, it seems. They're going heavily into the streaming video, you know, because it's go there, click on it, watch your movie, end of story. And I'm thinking that video and DVD and Blu-ray are probably going to become more of a boutique format, more for people like, well, you and me and most of the people who listen to the show, people who are seriously into film, people who are seriously into movies, who are into cinema. And I think it's going to become more, there's going to be more features. There's going to be more alternate cuts of movies. There's going to be more commentaries. I think this would be an interesting direction because they want to make sure that people buy these discs. Because right now, DVDs and Blu-rays are really cheap because, well, the bottom's falling out of the market because normal people are going, I don't need that. I'll just go to Netflix or whatever the equivalent is in other countries. But I think sooner or later, some enterprising soul at a distribution company is going to go, you know, what if we took Saw 12 and what if we turned it into sort of a special edition? Saw 12, the director's cut. Saw 12, the producer's cut. Saw 12, the caterer's cut. Put them all on one Blu-ray, plus we'll have commentary from all the actors, all the directors, everybody. We'll string it out, and then the fans of the Saw series will buy the discs for that reason, and we can sell them at an inflated price because they will become a specialty item. I mean, the people who want to see Saw 12 will just go streaming service, turn it on, watch it, bored, go home. But people who are seriously into the Saw series will be buying the discs. That was the thought that I kind of had about the future of video and film and stuff. One of the other things that occurs to me is that there was an article a week ago or something about how blockbusters have become so generic and so mediocre, largely because there's no longer a video market there's no longer a DVD Blu-ray market to support fans, or there's less of one. So they have to appeal to foreign countries, so they have to make films more basic and generic, like China, India, Japan. So they're making the films more lots of action. Forget the plot. The plot can be fixed in the audio mix. And it seems to me that the person who wrote this article also said that it was a hopeful sign at the same time, because what it meant that a lot more interesting movies would get made on lower budgets and bigger stars, better directors and writers would gravitate towards this because they would have more freedom because there wouldn't be as much risk. So sort of the notion that the promise of the indie market about 10, 20 years ago expanded out to more or less the mainstream. So I think what we might be looking at, if this person is right, and I'm not entirely sure I agree with them, but it was an interesting thought, is a blockbuster market and a market that aims for Netflix play, contract for television sales, cable sales, that kind of stuff. Anyway, like I say, love Paleo Cinema, love Martian Drive-In podcast. Warmest regards to you and Sally, and I hope things go well, are going better for both of you. And hopefully, Tammy and I will see you in Australia next year when she comes over to be guest of honor at SwanCon in Perth. I think she also told me she's going to be doing a week in Melbourne, so if you and Sally can't make it to Perth for SwanCon, hopefully we can hook up there and you can finally get to meet this guy who talks to you on Facebook all the time and find out who the hell Tamara Pierce is. So anyway, it's been good talking to you, and I hope you get this message, and have a good evening, and looking forward to the next episode. Bye-bye.
Yeah, thanks for that, Tim. Other people might have heard that voicemail on the last Martian Drive-In podcast, but because it flips over into Paleo Cinema, talks about both of them, I'm playing it again here. Yeah, I mean, we don't have Hulu and we don't have Netflix here, though. Marty Cook did hit me to how I can get both of them. Now, I'm not willing to pay for Netflix. I looked through it and there's nothing I can't get from a torrent, so why would I pay for it? But there is a way for me to fake pretending my internet connection is in America. And that way I can access the free Hulu service as opposed to Hulu Plus, which I have done a little bit, and I may well subscribe to the service that lets me pretend I'm from America. It runs about $6 or $7 a month. So I'm tempted to run that for a few months because there were some TV episodes that I wanted to watch and that I wasn't able to find otherwise. Things like episodes of My Living Doll with Julie Newmar and Robert Cummings in it, which was a childhood favourite of mine. And Julie Newmar was hot then. And by the way, happy birthday to Julie Newmar. She's on my Facebook and she just turned 80 and had some meditations on living a long life, which were quite interesting. So there is that. I watched that. I watched some episodes of some bad Irwin Allen TV shows like The Time Tunnel just for the fuck of it. I was in that kind of mood to not do anything too intellectually taxing, and TV series by Irwin Allen definitely filled that out. And so I may well do that because Hulu may be worth my while on the free service, but it's going to cost me about $6 a month to get the software to fake it in a sense. But that's got such a broad base of programs that it's probably worth me doing in that. So, yeah, I mean, as far as taking things from the cloud, I just had this weird mental image of grabbing things from the cloud and throwing them at a TV screen and watching my media that way. But to be honest with you, I'm a bit old school. Copies of things, I like having copies of things myself. I don't want to be at the whim of somebody else deciding that they're going to make things available or unavailable. It's kind of against the spirit of what I think about the internet should be. And I don't like it, even though there may be stakeholders or copyright holders and things like that. I like the idea of once I buy something, I have it. And the way some of the streaming services and some of the online purchase services like through iTunes and things like that. You are at the whim of those people once you've bought something, which is kind of something of which I'm a little wary. But having said that, I have bought a couple of things to put on my iPad from iTunes at times when I've been given vouchers and things like that. But in general, I tend to spend that kind of money on games, just little iPad games to while away the time and things like that. But yeah, I mean, the future is going to change things. Media has changed enormously in my lifetime, and I don't for a second see any sign of it slowing down. But and then you've got other platforms coming up, like when Google Glasses get really good. Are we going to be able to kind of turn them fully to screens and watch our media on our sunglasses, in a sense? So there's that as another possibility. I'm interested to see what will happen with those kind of technologies. And I don't think that's... If it has too much of a negative impact on the viewer, of course, they won't use it. But I still like buying copies of movies. In fact, today I got three Blu-rays. They had a buy two, get one free sale down at JB. So I picked up Paths of Glory, Stanley Kubrick's The Killing, and Vanishing Point, and got them all for about $30 for the three of them. So I still like that. I still like those kind of serendipitous purchases. In a sense, you're looking for something else, and then, bam, you find something that really does grab you. But, yeah, I mean, things will change, but who knows exactly where they'll go and what kind of pushback the consumer will have against any changes that are made. But, okay, let me see if I've got anything else here. Nope, but I'll give you another reason to go and link up to the Paleo Cinema Cafe as well. Sometimes I find links to full feature films on YouTube, and I will post them embedded on the Facebook page of the Paleo Cinema Cafe. I know that Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema have a thread where they're doing it as well, and you can go to that. They get a lot more stuff and a lot more things that I wouldn't be interested in, but which you might, that are showing up as full films on YouTube. It's worth doing a little bit of a troll yourself now and then, just see what they do have available as well. But I'm going to wrap it up now. Everybody, enjoy your movie viewing. I'll be back in a fortnight with another Martian Drive-In podcast. I have no idea what I'm going to be doing for that, which is exciting. And I'm just going to go away now and watch a couple of movies. Haven't decided what yet. But if you follow me as Cult Guru on Mizo, you can kind of track what I've been watching if you're interested. See, I'm trying to push people to be interactive here. But anyway, look after yourselves. Enjoy your movie watching. Get yourself some good coffee. Kick back and enjoy your life. And I'll be back in a fortnight with a Martian Drive-In podcast, and in 4 weeks with another Paleo Cinema. Catch you then.